Experiencing Incredible India. This is the Wild Eye Podcast. Hey everybody, my name is Jerry, I'm from Wild Eye. And in this episode, I am going to hand over to Johan and Trevor, who have just returned from India. Johan was there for just, I think, short of a month, and Trevor joined him for about 2 weeks. Johan ran a private, and then the two of them hosted our incredible India safari. And in this one, they talk you through the whole experience, the lodges, the wildlife, the photography, and I need to get there one day. Can't wait. Hope you guys enjoy this one.
Okay. Trev, how's it going?
Good, thanks, and yourself, Jan?
Good, man. How was India?
Yes, where to even begin, hey? It's been 3 years in the making due to the pandemic.
Yeah.
I mean, I was excited 3 years ago, but for the trip to actually finally be here, and having discussed your previous trip a couple of years ago, I was really, really excited to go there. I think nothing can quite prepare you for India.
Yeah.
If you just think of the trips that we generally run, it's a very, very different experience altogether.
Yes.
So I tried to go into it with, obviously, having had your advice, and you hosted a private literally just before I got there, we chatted quite a bit about India, things to take, how to prepare, all of that kind of stuff. And I think it gives you a certain level of comfort, but I don't think it quite prepares you for the experience itself.
Yeah.
And I don't think, even though we're doing this podcast now, it's going to be very difficult to portray exactly how India is and what it's like. I mean, there's so many different aspects to it, and I think it's so different to anything that we have ever experienced.
Yeah.
The wildlife side of things is also completely different. The culture, I think for me, the culture was the biggest thing. I mean, you see, for example, the IPL cricket on TV, yeah, and all of that kind of stuff. And even that, I don't think prepares you for, you know, when we travel from here, it's an 8-hour flight from here to Doha. Then I think I had about a 3-hour layover, then 3.5 hours to New Delhi. And once I hit New Delhi, it was just like walking into a completely different world.
Yeah, let's get to that, because we're gonna chat about the different parks and things pretty soon. But talk to me about, you know, arriving into Delhi, because I mean, as the trip starts, we spend one night in Delhi at the Radisson, yes, Hotel, which is luckily it's close to the airport. Talk to me about that drive just from the airport to the Radisson Hotel.
What? It's hard to describe. Firstly, it's a lot of travel, which is fine. But I think from the moment you walk out the airport, it is very overwhelming.
Yeah.
I mean, it's people everywhere. It's chaos. And I don't mean it in a bad way. I mean, it's just a different
way. It is what it is.
It is what it is, and it's just a different way of living.
There's 1.4 billion people there.
Exactly. And I think, you know, we travel to all these different countries, and you think of Kenya and Nairobi and driving around and how their rules are very different to how we drive and operate in South Africa. Now you go to Delhi, and it's a whole nother level. I don't think I've ever heard as many hooters,
yeah,
in my life.
No, look, they love a hooter.
They love a hooter. For what reason, I don't know. I mean, there's random hooting at random times.
It's like an official language over there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think, you know, an experience like this and like India, and where you're going into an area where it's completely foreign, everything is foreign, the people are foreign. You know, the people that we spoke to and that we met were great, very, very nice. There obviously is a bit of a language barrier in certain areas and with certain people, but, you know, they do make the effort. So yeah, it was that drive, it's 10-15 minutes, but I was completely blown away by it. Like, I didn't know what was going on, I didn't know where I was, I didn't know where I was heading to. Was I gonna actually meet up with you at the Radisson? I had no idea. So that in itself was an experience to try and process once I got to the hotel. Yeah. But also a very cool experience, because it's just, you know, a nice thing about visiting a destination or a new country for the first time is that you get to experience it through the eyes of our guests.
Yeah.
You know, so we go to the Mara, we know what to expect, we know how to prep the guests, we know the kind of experience that we're going to be giving the guests and what we can expect. And if there are any hiccups along the way, we know roughly what they're going to be like. But when you go to a place like India for the first time, where it's completely out of our comfort zone, you have to embrace it. I think, you know, you've got to understand that different countries across the world, different safari experiences, different expedition experiences, they all differ in their own way. So you can't go, and I try to go with this mentality, you can't go that it's going to be like traveling from Johannesburg to the Sabi Sands, yeah, and that's what the experience is like. Yeah. It's completely different. So you can't go with that expectation. You've got to go very open-minded and literally just embrace the experience for what it is. And I think once you do that, you find a lot more enjoyment out of it.
100%. I think the key word you said there is to embrace it. So let's talk about the itinerary. So we spent the night in the Radisson, very comfortable hotel,
yeah,
good food. There's a nice little restaurant there. We had dinner with some of the guests the night before. And then we had a very early start in the morning. I think we left the Radisson at about 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Just after three, yeah, to then transfer back to the airport. And then we had about an hour and a half's flight into Nagpur.
Yeah.
Very comfortable plane. It's like a Boeing 737 that we used. And then for this year, it's the first time we used Todoba. We went in there blind. I've never been there. You've never, yeah, been there. And it was quite a nice surprise, because, I mean, first of all, it's a very short drive from Nagpur. It's about a 2.5-hour, yeah, drive to, yeah, to Todoba. And the company that we used, Pak Dundee, they just opened up a new camp in Todoba called, I think, Wagoba Eco Lodge.
Yes.
Tell me about your first impressions of the lodge. I mean, it's still obviously brand new.
Yeah, so I think, if I'm not mistaken, they were scheduled to open in 2020.
Yes.
But then obviously with the pandemic, it delayed all of that, and they only opened last year.
Yeah, I think it's like only been open for 6 months.
Six months or so. So driving in there, you can see it's a new lodge. I mean, there's still a lot going on, but I think one thing that stood out immediately when we got there was the people, so the hospitality.
Yeah.
I mean, from the GM right the way down.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the general manager and his moustache story.
He was
a killer.
Very proud of that moustache.
But I think the first thing that hit me was the hospitality side of it. I mean, they were on it from the word get-go. The lodge itself it's beautiful. I think, to be honest, it probably needs another year or so just for the vegetation, because obviously, sure, they've done a lot of landscaping and that around the lodge, and they're obviously still maintaining that. And I think once that's all fully grown you know, the lodge, how do I describe it?
Just needs to mature.
It just, yeah, needs to mature, yeah, yeah. But having said that, it doesn't mean that it wasn't a pleasant experience. It was a great experience. I actually loved the lodge.
Yeah.
You know, the arrangements of the lodge, the main area, they've got a swimming pool there. They've also got a hide there for during the day. So, I mean, we were there now and it was blisteringly hot. So you can imagine the bird life that comes down to the water during the day. So when you've got a bit of time off, you can go and sit there and photograph birds. The rooms were great. Really, really nice, I thought. Yeah. Very comfortable. And then the food as well. The food was great, you know. And throughout all the different camps, what stuck out was obviously they're very aware of international visitors.
Sure.
So they were always accommodating in terms of, obviously, you're going to India, so you're going to have Indian cuisine.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is very, very hot.
Yeah, yeah. Your people think chilies,
yeah,
and
yeah,
lots of it.
Yeah, but through all the lodges, I mean, they made sure that everybody was happy with the food. And, Yeah, I think I was just overall impressed with what stood out the most was the people side of it. And just the way that they operated the lodges was fantastic.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that's also very different from India is that obviously all the camps are outside the park. So I think with all of the camps that we stayed at, it's roughly about a 20, anything between 15 and 25 minutes to the gates. Getting into Tadoba, I think it was probably maybe 20 minutes, half an hour that we were in and we found our first tiger.
Yeah.
Talk us through that, you know, the first time you see it, because if we look at, you know, our tiger sightings that we had over the 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and you compare that first tiger sighting where it was, I mean, you could literally see a couple of stripes between the bamboo. And I remember everyone was just picking up their cameras and just firing away. Just getting shots. Describe that feeling, you know, having obviously seen tigers in documentaries and photos of it compared to seeing it in real life.
You know, going into it and it being a photographic trip, obviously you want to come out of it with great photographs.
Mm.
But, and I think, I mean, the vehicle that I was on will agree with me. I mean, we drove part. So obviously our two cars always stay together.
Yes.
Just so that we would see pretty much the same stuff.
Yeah.
And what happened that first afternoon was we were in front of you guys and suddenly you guys disappeared. Okay. So then we were like, so we stopped and we waited and we listened. And we were like, no, they must have seen something. So we literally reversed for about 2 kilometers and then we found you guys and you guys pointed out where the tiger was. And like you said, it was off in the distance in the bamboo and literally you could just see its belly with stripes. And I didn't even really think about my camera. It was such an overwhelming feeling. You know, you do, like you mentioned, you see them in these documentaries and you have a feeling of what it's going to be like because, I mean, we've seen lions and leopards and cheetahs and that all in the wild. So you have a feeling of what it's going to be like. But when you see something for the first time, even if it's in the densest vegetation, it was an overwhelming feeling because to be in a position where, you know, tiger numbers are declining, but to be in a position where you can see a tiger in the wild, even if it's just its stripes, I mean, it honestly gave me goosebumps. Mm. And I sat there and I was with Gene and Barbara Birch, and I sat there and I said to them, take a couple of proof shots. They were ready. They were ready, but also just realize where you are. And I mean, how many people get the opportunity to say that they've seen a tiger in the wild? And it wasn't just that moment. I think it was everything that led up to that moment. You know, driving into the park for the first time, it's completely different vegetation, completely different bird noises, sounds of the forest, the light penetrating the forest, the bamboo thickets. It's all so new and so overwhelming and so different to what I'm used to. And then on top of that, within the first 20, 30 minutes, you throw in a tiger. Yeah. It's a very, very overwhelming feeling.
Yeah.
Luckily for us, he did then get up and move, and we did have a not great photographically, but to start off our trip with a tiger within the first half an hour, I mean, if you told me that's what was going to happen, I would say there's not a single chance.
Yeah.
And just to see their sheer size and the power that that animal has is incredible. And then to follow that, I mean, we drove down the road for another 15 minutes and there was another tiger in the water.
Yeah.
Obviously a bit better for photographs and things like that, but I just remember sitting there thinking, is this actually real? Am I here?
Yeah.
You know, like it's a very hard experience to describe when you're feeling that overwhelmed, because it's something, seeing a tiger in the wild, it's like any of us who have bucket list destinations and wildlife that we want to see. I mean, I'm 33 years old. I've been dreaming of seeing tigers ever since I watched Jungle Book for the first time.
Yeah.
And now you're suddenly in that moment where you're physically in India, in the jungle.
Where the Jungle Book was basically created.
Exactly. Yeah. Watching a tiger. It's an unbelievable feeling, and it's very difficult to put into words.
Yeah. So one of the things where Todoba is a little bit different. So at each of the camps at Park Dundee, you've got a naturalist, right? So which is equivalent to your guide or driver that you'll have in South Africa.
Correct.
So your guide will be driving. Over there, they call them naturalists. And then in the other parks, you will have a forest ranger that will come on almost to a degree, the trackers that we will get in South Africa. Yeah. They won't sit on the front on the bonnet. They'll sit in the passenger seat next to the naturalist or the guide. But at Todoba, it's a little bit different. Whereas the naturalist at Todoba can't actually drive the vehicle. So I don't know what the reason is for this. I don't know if it's like just their park rules or if it's a case of them still needing to get the vehicles in, whatever it might be. But it worked a little bit differently. So you've got a driver, and then we had a naturalist, and then you had a forest guide in. So we had five guests. We split up three guests in one vehicle with one either Trevor or myself, and another vehicle with two people in it. Yeah. So the naturalist was just in the one vehicle, which the naturalist was just in the one vehicle, which it made it a little bit sort of different experience. And you also could not use cell phone footage. You couldn't use your cell phone to take videos.
It
was
the only park that we couldn't.
Only park. And apparently it's because there was an incident where a tourist used a mobile phone and the tiger charged or whatever, and I don't know. It's a bit of a weird concept, but anyway. So that Todoba does operate a little bit differently to a lot of the other parks. So it's something just to keep in mind. But the tiger viewing we had there was incredible. I think we had eight different tigers there.
Yeah. And one thing I wanted to mention, I think it's what helped me a lot was, obviously, with us going to India, for example, you've been there before. It was my first time. So where the naturalist became a bit challenging was when I didn't have the naturalist.
Yes.
But the beauty of it is that I had, not to blow my own horn here, but obviously I have had guiding experience.
Yes.
So although it's different animals and different birds and things that you're seeing, I still had the ability to translate that behavior
exactly
to the guests. Yep. And also with the driver, obviously chat to him and communicate with him in terms of positioning of the vehicle and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And a lot of that came from reading your past blog post, as well as having chats with you in terms of what animals you can expect to see and all of that kind of stuff. So it was a bit challenging not having the naturalist, but I think having us wild eye guides makes a big difference because of the experience that we've had in different parks.
Yeah. And I mean, photographically, you could put yourself in any place and you'll be able to assist the people. And, you know, having a lot of that sort of big cat experience with lions, leopard, almost cheetah to a degree as well, it's not that much different to a tiger's behavior.
No, not at all.
I think the biggest challenge is probably, you know, getting used to all the sounds, because in India, where we focus a lot on the tracking and visual, because our parks are a bit more open, 90% of it there is sound-based.
Yeah. You know,
listening for alarm calls, and that's often where they then decide to drive. I think that's probably the most challenging part, is to know the different birds and things, which that just comes over time. But also just identify the different sounds and kind of what they mean.
Yeah.
But from a photographic point of view, I mean, like you said, you've got the experience.
Yeah.
You can put yourself anywhere in the world and you'll be able to know how to photograph
it. Yeah. I think one of the biggest difference in terms of like the wildlife experience, if you compare it to a Southern African safari, like you said, with tracking down animals and things like that, is a lot of these parks that we visited obviously have plenty of water sources.
Yes.
So it's different sounds that you're listening for, because you'll randomly drive and then you'll just stop and turn off and you think, okay, well, you actually have no idea what's going on. But it's like you said, it's 80-90% based on listening.
Yeah.
You're listening for alarm calls, what directions it's coming from. And then the other 10-20% is driving from one waterhole to the next and then back again, which in my mind, I think, if I was in South Africa on safari, I drive a waterhole, I check there's nothing, okay, I leave it, and that's me done for the afternoon.
Mm.
Whereas I don't even know, there was a number of times where we would literally do a circuit of 2, 3, 4 different waterholes constantly throughout the morning or the afternoon.
Yeah.
And on your third or fourth attempt at the same waterhole, suddenly there's a tiger.
Yeah.
So it's also wrapping your head around, because I'm used to checking a waterhole, okay, move on, check the next one, okay, move on, check the next one. Because it also, if you look at the mornings, when we would enter the parks, there was tracks for tigers everywhere, up and down, all over the show. And to establish which one's the freshest track and which one you should be following is virtually impossible. Mm. There was one morning where we had a male tiger track, a female tiger track, and a leopard track all in one place.
Yeah.
And to try and work out, and in those forests as well, obviously the parks vary and the visibility varies, but if a tiger, I was amazed that if you're watching a tiger moving through the forest and it's walking parallel to the road, if you're watching that tiger and you turn away and you pick up your camera and you look back,
it's gone.
You struggle to see it again. You need to get someone to point it out. That's how good their camouflage is.
Yeah.
And I think, if you go in not understanding, and this is one thing that you prepped me about, was going from waterhole to waterhole. And, if you don't understand the process, I think you could get quite frustrated with it.
Yeah.
Because you're wondering, why am I going from A to B, B to A to B, back and forth? But there is a method to it.
Yes.
And it paid off for us. It really, really did.
I think also one of the things to mention is also that they don't have radios in the vehicles.
Yeah.
So, whereas in South Africa, we could say, okay, cool, I've checked this waterhole. Another guy that's maybe 5 minutes behind you, he might go back to that same waterhole. If he finds something, he can radio to say, listen, turn around and come back. Whereas over there, and I actually enjoy it to a degree. If it works for you, it's nice not having a radio. If it doesn't work for you, you'll say, oh, I wish we had a radio.
Yeah.
But, can you imagine if that radio would be going nonstop if there was one.
Yeah.
And we'll get to the vehicles and those things a little bit later on. So you don't have a radio. So you, like you say, you constantly check those water holes, see what's happening. Your highlight from Todoba. So we spent, just to recap, so we spent 3 nights to start off at Todoba. So we had 6 game drives there.
Yeah.
What's your highlight?
My highlight. So
from the 6 drives that we had there.
So obviously when we arrived, we chatted to the naturalists and just got an idea about the wildlife, and they mentioned to us how good the tiger population was there. So he also mentioned to us that in one of the areas there was a female with 3 youngsters.
Yep.
And that they had been seen on a fairly regular basis and they had been staying in roughly the same area. And I think my biggest highlight was over a 2-day period. So I think it was like our second afternoon or whatever. We hadn't seen them yet. Had we seen them yet?
We just had a glimpse of them.
We had a brief glimpse of them in the morning.
They had a kill in the thickets, yeah.
So we had a brief glimpse of them. So we decided to go out in the afternoon and literally be patient and wait. There was a water body close by. And
yes, it was hot that day.
Yeah, and so Todoba was also the only camp that we left, I think it was 1:45 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Blisteringly hot.
And it was probably the hottest place.
Yeah, agreed. So we went out that afternoon, we literally went straight to that area and we sat there for the entire afternoon, hoping that they would come out. It didn't pay off for us with regards to the tiger and the youngsters coming out, but we saw sloth bear.
We did. That's right.
So we were sitting there while we were waiting. A sloth bear popped out and we got to photograph that.
I forgot about that.
And it was super hot, but you know, I know you've said it before as well, you know, if you put in the time and you have the patience, you will be rewarded. It may be not always be in the way you want it to be. Like, for example, that afternoon we wanted the tiger and the cubs to come out, but we were rewarded with the sloth bear.
Yes.
Which, if we had been driving around, we may have seen absolutely nothing.
I'm a firm believer of that. Yeah.
And the next morning we decided to give it another crack.
Yes.
And this is where I firmly believe that this is where our patience from the previous 100%. Day paid off, because 100%. It was probably one of our best tiger sightings we had. So we came into the area, massive open area surrounded by forest, very dense vegetation and a large water body. And as we approached it, we came across a male tiger who was lying on the opposite bank of the water. So he was obviously the dad of the cubs. And then we literally drove 50 meters further, and there was mom and the youngsters. And mom and the male tiger then decided to, well, he noticed the mom and the youngsters. He decided to then move off into the thicket. The mom then moved towards where the male tiger was, and the youngsters were playing with each other, jumping on mom. They went for a drink. They were running in the water. They were splashing in the water.
Madness.
And then suddenly chaos broke out. There was a spotted deer that came bolting through that the female tiger first saw. But then there was four wild dogs that were chasing the spotted deer, all in the open.
Yeah.
And then the tiger obviously realized that the cubs were in danger. And it was amazing to see, because from us, there's so much animal behavior that's unknown to us, but those cubs instinctively just vanished. Yeah. They disappeared.
Well, we didn't see them
again. We didn't see them again after that. And she went tearing off after the wild dogs, and the dogs were making this weird alarm noise.
The sounds were just ridiculous.
It was crazy. And she chased the wild dogs off, and then the wild dog came back, and then we decided to do a loop, and we bumped into the female tiger again on the road.
Yep.
That was after having a wild dog running down the road towards us. So then we bumped into her, then we went back around, and apparently the male had made another appearance, but he had gone into the thickets. So we went back to where we had originally positioned for the tiger and the cubs, and then she came out again.
Yeah.
And she went into the water, but she was obviously very concerned about the wild dogs, and the wild dog pack had now been split.
The shots of her swimming through the water towards us.
Crazy. Amazing. And I mean, she got up, she came, she walked close by to the vehicle, she walked up and down, and then she walked back into the water. And I think for me, the highlight of all of that was just having the whole story come together from the previous afternoon. I mean, I've got to take my hats off to the guests. You know, I understand it's not easy to sit in 40 degree plus degrees Celsius for the whole afternoon, literally not moving, waiting for tigers with no shade. It's not easy. But the highlight for me was having put in that time and then having the sighting that we had the following day.
Absolutely.
Just made it all worthwhile.
Absolutely. And I think we finished off with about eight individual tigers in Todoba, which was the perfect start. And it's exactly what we wanted for the trip, because it takes that initial pressure off.
Yeah.
People have seen tigers. I mean, the sightings that we had, we couldn't have asked for better sightings to start off with. Then our next place we moved onto was Pench. A Pench has been part of the itinerary like all along. And that was a bit of a longer drive. So we then had to drive back towards Nagpur, which is about 2.5 hours, and then 3 hours to Pench from there. So it was about a 5.5 hour drive. Got into Pench. So we did a morning drive at Todoba, so we didn't do an afternoon drive at Pench.
Yeah.
Settled in. And we gave, like, we were pretty clear with our brief to the guests to say, listen, okay, Todoba, now we've got the tiger sightings. Pench and Kano, we wanted to focus on the general game stuff, because the last thing you want to do is, you know, go to India and all your people focus on are tigers. You know, then you just get a portfolio of just tigers and you don't photograph the deers.
But also, I think in that mentality, you're missing out on so much.
100%.
You're missing out. And I think you were spot on it. You know, Pench, okay, we did see a tiger there, which was impressive. But Pench, from a reserve point of view, is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
And completely different to
very
Tsukuba.
Different. Very, very different.
And the amount of general game in that there was incredible.
Yeah. I think it's one of the parks with the highest density of general game. You know, you spotted deers and Indian gores, good monkeys to photograph. They're a lot of fun to photograph. Yeah. I think it's people often look past that, but I think the times that we photographed them, people really enjoyed spending time with them and just seeing the behavior.
Yeah, yeah. I think between all the parks, I think spending time with monkeys, if you added up the amount of time, we probably spent a good couple of hours photographing monkeys.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I wanted to ask you, so I know we're going through each destination, but with that, you've got the buffer zone and then you've got the reserve.
Yes.
So the lodges are all outside of the reserve.
Yeah.
What is your feeling towards that positioning of a lodge being outside a reserve in comparison to like Southern Africa, where your lodge is inside the reserve, you leave for game drive and you leave straight out the bat, you're in the reserve?
Yeah, look, I think it's an interesting one. Initially, I thought it was going to be an issue, but I do also like the reserve being exactly that, you know, just being left to its own thing. No human influence, because if you think about it, the lodges in a way do have an impact in a reserve. You know, obviously in Africa you're dealing with massive areas, and but those lodges could have been an animal's pathway that he used to walk, elephants or whatever it might be. Yeah. So I actually like the fact that it's in the buffer zone, and it also, I think, especially with, you know, having kids and things come to the lodges and things, it is just a little bit safer to have them. But I mean, you know, I think the Indian parks have been very clear that they want the parks to just be just for the wildlife with as little human impact as they possibly can.
Yeah.
And then have the lodges out on the buffer zone. I didn't, I think it takes some getting used to, but once you're used to it, I didn't have a problem with, you know, driving through those villages and things.
Because that's also, I think, part of the experience.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, the lodges are in the buffer zone as well. So, you know, I was thinking more you're going to be sitting out in the middle of a village and all you're going to hear is kids and music and all sorts. But in those buffer zones, I mean, we heard alarm calls for animals and you still get the forest noises. And although you drive through a village to get to the reserve and through a village to get back to the lodge, once you're at the lodge, you actually don't feel, it didn't have that feeling that we're situated outside the reserve.
Yeah. No, it still feels as like part of the forest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think it's also, I was trying to think of other places where it could be used, because I think that buffer zone works really, really well. Mm. You know, there's obviously no fences or anything like that. And I think that's where obviously the park authorities and that have been very, very good. And I think that's also where the utilization of the forest guides also helps a lot, you know, because with many of these wilderness areas, poaching is a big problem.
Sure.
Whereas now you're bringing in these forest guides who are from the local village. So you're creating employment for them.
100%.
And then, like you said, you know, with a population of 1.4 billion people, these reserves, I think it's almost more important, it's hard to say more important than other reserves like in Southern Africa, but it's important to keep these wilderness areas and these reserves that we visited as pristine as possible.
Yeah.
And as I mean, there's no off-roading or anything like that, which is, it can be a bit of a bollock at times, but I understand the reasoning behind it.
For sure.
You know, we're in a country where people are encroaching more and more into these wilderness areas, that buffer zone, I think, just aids to stop people from going further and further into these wilderness areas and taking over space in the forest for the tigers and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah. I think I read a thing that, you know, India is 20 times more populated than the USA, than America. So that just puts puts it into perspective. So, I mean, and these parks that we're talking about is not small. You know, you're talking about areas that is, it's the same size and some are bigger than Madikwe. You're talking about 150,000 acres, 200,000 acres upwards. Yeah. So, you know, it's not a small little zoo that you're driving around. And if you think about it, it's actually a miracle that there are still these places around there. Like you say, with 1.4 billion people, you know, I think these parks, these parks are under a lot more pressure than in Southern Africa, for example.
Yeah.
Because if you look at, you know, where you drive in Southern Africa, you can often drive in a couple of hours where there's absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Whereas the villages are pretty close, and, you know, that buffer zone, you've got farmland in there. You know, guys farming wheat, and, you know, they've got cattle roaming around. So the human-animal conflict is there for everyone to see.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's under a huge amount of pressure, that those parks. And that's why I think, and we can actually move on to that subject now, is, you know, a lot of people often complain about how busy the parks are in India. But I don't know if you had a look now, probably about 90-95% of it is local tourism.
Mm.
So they've gone the route where they're making it affordable for local people to go and visit. Mm. They're getting the local people's buy-in, because, I mean, wildlife photography has become a massive thing in India. You know, everyone wants to be a wildlife photographer. But they're supporting these parks.
Mm.
Now, if they were relying on international travel, those parks, there's no way in hell they'll be able to, first of all, make money or employ those forest guides. And then your poaching is going to increase.
Those areas will just disappear.
Those areas are going to be done, and then tigers are going to be done. You know, so they've gone the opposite route to what we've done in Southern Africa, where we've almost shut out our local tourism completely. I mean, if you go to Sabi Sands, how many South Africans can, you know, afford to go to some of these lodges and Botswana and those places?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's something to bear in mind. Yes, the parks are busy, and you got to prepare yourself for that. But I think, you know, just... I think it's a little bit ignorant saying you're not going to go to these parks because, you know, they're so busy. I think these parks need to be busy. They need to get the local people's buy-in from a conservation point of view in order for them to survive.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think once you understand that's what we've got to do to keep tigers alive, and you put into perspective, you know, it's not like a place like Botswana that's the size of Texas with 3 million people in there.
Yeah, yeah.
You live in a country, yes, India's big, but 1.4 billion people is a lot of people.
It is, yeah. Yeah, and I think you raise a good point there. I mean, that I think back to that first afternoon in Tadoba, and I think it was our second tiger sighting.
That was one hell of a dog show. That was one afternoon we were just sitting in like, oh, my hat.
Yeah, but I think, you know, a big part of it is one, you mentioned it. I mean, I think it's crucial. It's vital for the parks in India to make it affordable for locals to enter the park. And two, I think it depends on, I mean, it comes down to you get what you pay for as well. You know, you did a lot of research into Pug Dundee safaris and their camps and how they operate and all of that. And then I think it's also decision making when you're out in the field. You know, like, yes, you want to see tigers, and you know, you get to an area and there's 20 vehicles parked there waiting for a tiger to come out. But, you know, having the local knowledge of the naturalists and that's on the vehicle, I mean, they would often discuss with us and say, you know, it's super busy here, let's just go and check one water hole or two water holes in case there's a tiger there. And then if there isn't, we can always come back here. And I mean, how often did that work in our favor? Yep. So yes, you see some sightings, there may be 20 plus vehicles there and it's a brief glimpse of a tiger, but that is part of the experience. You've got to accept it. But if you go in with the mentality that we did and how we operated with the naturalists, I mean, we were rewarded on a number of occasions. It wasn't only once where it was only our two vehicles or our two vehicles and one or two other vehicles in a tiger sighting.
Sure.
So you do still have those intimate moments with the wildlife.
Yeah. And the beauty with a lot of these parks, and especially, you know, having experienced Tadoba, and then we'll get to Banavgarh, there are enough tigers there that you can say, okay, listen, let's leave these crowds for this one. We're going to go look for another one.
Yeah, yeah.
And 9 times out of 10, we found our own,
exactly.
Our own tiger. We had a total of 24 tigers during the trip. How many can you remember that you thought, oh, you know, this is actually either spoiling my sighting photographically, or, you know, we just totally harassing this animal?
I never really felt like that. You know, the times where, I mean, to be honest, it is chaotic when you've got a lot of vehicles and there's a tiger. Yeah. Like that's it is what it is.
Yeah.
But one thing I've got to say is that, you know, if a tiger was approaching the road, the local guys were very aware of very giving respectful. Space.
Yeah, yeah.
And allowing that animal to cross the road.
Yeah.
You know, whereas I would have been a lot more frustrated if people were just constantly pushing an animal to the point where it changes its direction completely and moves further into the forest. So I think there is a lot, although there's a lot of vehicles and it can be chaotic at times, I think there is a respect for the animal there, which I certainly appreciated it, and I never really felt like it spoilt any of our sightings. You know, I think this trip, it is a long trip, but I think having that in your mind as well allows you to say, okay, guys, you know, this sighting is very busy. It's not great photographically. And
exactly.
Let's move on and see what else we're going to find.
And I think that's where, you know, like we say, it is what it is. I think the local guides are very respectful. I think they get super excited when there is a tiger. And that could often be maybe interpreted as, you know, them being disrespectful to the wildlife, but I don't think that's the case.
You know,
they really treasure tigers especially, and they are respectful to it, but they do get super excited. People are loud, they get excited, and even the guides. But I think that's important where we're on board and we can say to the guy, listen, cool, we've had a good sighting now. That animal is walking on the road or is just walking off the road. Let's leave it be. You know, we're not going to get better photographs, especially if you've had killer photos in the beginning.
Yeah.
No, let's let it be. First of all, you're getting away from those vehicles, and then you're also leaving that sighting knowing that you had as little of an impact on that animal as you possibly could have.
I think an important thing to highlight as well is that, you know, we spoke about how hot it was and the number of people and that in certain sightings and things, and, you know, before going to India, you see photos where there's a tiger in the road and there's 15 cars behind it, and you think, this is a shit show.
Yeah,
like, I don't want to experience that. But having been there, when you see that tiger, you forget about any noise that's being made. Mm. You forget about any vehicles that are around you. You are completely fixated on tiger.
For sure.
And whether there's other vehicles in the background or not, it does not matter.
No.
I can tell you, and I'm not just saying that to say, you know, like, you've got to go and do it.
Yeah.
Honestly, to be in that position, you forget about everything else around you. You are completely fixated on that tiger.
Yeah. I think in the 24 whatever tiger sightings we had, I'm trying to think, there was one in Karna, where it was like late in the evening, we'd cross the road where there were a lot of vehicles. And then, like you mentioned, that one afternoon in Todoba.
The first afternoon
where there was like a whole bunch of cars and those big buses. But other than that, you know, because you're parking on the road, so you're parking in one line, the guys technically can't make two lines on the road, because then there's obviously no space for the vehicles to pass through. So you're all parking in one line, and you're either photographing to the left or right hand side of that road, usually at a waterhole. So you don't have vehicles in your way.
Yeah.
And you're also not really impacting the animal, because, you know, unless he wants to cross the road, which in that particular case, the guys will make space.
Yeah.
But you're photographing all towards one side, animals in the water.
Yeah.
So it's not really having an impact on that animal, and it's not having an impact on your photos either. So that's, like we said, you know, we're not going to sugarcoat it and say it's not going to be like, you know, in some reserves in South Africa where you're the only vehicle for 3 hours.
Yeah, sure.
But you, like, you know, for the for the reasons that we've mentioned already, you know, why it is important those people are there, it doesn't really impact on your photographic experience.
No.
Talk to me about, so Penge was stop two. We've spoken a little bit about the park. Very, very different. So these massive teak trees, like a dry deciduous forest, beautiful general game. Let's talk about the lodge, the tree lodge. And what your thoughts? What it looked
like. it's beautifully laid out. Because I think they've got 6 tree houses and 6 cottages.
That's right, yeah.
You stayed in both. We stayed in the cottage, very, very comfortable. Yeah. I think the rooms are decorated beautifully. Mm. Once again, on arrival there, you notice immediately is the hospitality side of things. The briefing of the camp and everything was great. I think the layout of the camp is also very, very good. Mm. You know, there's a lot of space in between the rooms, so you've got your privacy. I don't have experience of the tree houses where all of the guests stayed, but I can imagine it's pretty spectacular, yeah, having a bit of a vantage point. And then once again, the food was great. I'm just trying to think of what else there. I think just in terms of the lodge itself, I didn't expect the lodges to be, it was probably one of my favorite lodges just because of the design of it.
Yeah.
I think the architecture was beautiful. Mm. And yeah, as an overall experience, I'd definitely love to go back there.
Yeah. No, it's a great park. And it's, you know, in the past, I must be honest, I haven't had a lot of tiger sightings there. And it's not because there's not a lot of tigers there, but it's such a massive park. And there's also pretty big blocks, right? So if a tiger goes across the road into the forest, it'll take a long time for him to get to the next road. So your chances of seeing tigers there are probably less than, you know, something like Todoba or Bundavgar. Yeah. But having said that, we had a cracking sighting of that big male in the water. Yeah, and again, you know, that's one of the beauties of going there in April when it's so hot, is seeing them there in the summer months when they get to the water. But our focus there was to photograph general game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then the pressure was off. It was almost as if the tigers were coming towards us.
Yeah.
So we spent again 3 nights at Penge. We only did 3 safaris there because we ended up being there on a Wednesday.
Yes.
Wednesday afternoons, the parks close.
Yeah.
So we had 3 game drives there, which was good for what we wanted to do. Then we did a drive from Penge to Kana, which is also about 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
Getting into Kana, talk to me about the difference between Kana, you know, first impressions compared to like Penge.
Kana, sure. You see, the lodges are all so different.
Yeah.
Like, they're very luxurious, but they're all very different. Kana felt to me like, before the trip, if I were to have pictured a lodge in a jungle in India, Kana is what I would picture. It's hard to explain.
The salt trees are just
it's
incredible.
Beautiful. It really, really is beautiful. And once again, like the decor in the lodges, and what I actually really loved about the different lodges, okay, we didn't do it at all the lodges, was that they offer documentaries and things in the evenings. So you sit and you learn a little bit. And it's all, because we visited Central India, all the documentaries take place in the reserves that we visited.
Exactly.
So I think that's a nice touch that the lodges have done, was that you can choose each evening if you do want to see a documentary or if you don't. Have your drink and a starter, you watch the documentary, it gives you a little bit more in depth into the area that you're driving around, challenges that the wildlife and the tigers are facing, and a little bit about the animal behavior and all of that. But the lodge itself, just it felt like I was in the middle of a jungle in India.
Yeah.
It really, really was beautiful.
It's probably my favorite lodge out of all of them, Kana Earth Lodge. It's spectacular camp. Kana is also, it's very different, whereas in Penge you don't have zones, so you can drive anywhere that you want. Kano, you've got different zones that you cruise in. So that's, you know, the idea behind that is to let the vehicle split up a little bit. We were there over a very busy time. We were there over Easter. Yeah. So it was busier than normal. And one of the things it's a bit of a pain is, you know, the main gate that we go through, everyone goes there and then they split off in their zone. So you get to the gate, you're like, wow, look at all these vehicles.
Mm.
Especially if you sort of towards the back of the queue. But then once you go through the gate, the vehicle split up, then it gets a little bit better. I can't remember the tiger sightings. Do we have any good tiger sightings at Kona? We had that one at the waterhole.
We had one at the waterhole. I think we had one on the first afternoon, but brief. It was like it was a sub-adult, and it was in long grass, and I think it was still quite nervous of people and vehicles, so it moved off. But I think the important thing that you highlighted is the zones. So not all the parks have the zones, but all the parks have a limit to the number of vehicles they allow in. So even though we've chatted about how busy a couple of the sightings have been, it's never going to be that you're going to have 200 vehicles in one sighting, because they don't allow that many vehicles. You're only allowed whether there's zones or not, you're only allowed a certain number of vehicles in the park in the morning, in the afternoon, or for the full day. And that's where I think the zones are quite crucial, and where they work quite well for us, because I think you have like a maximum of 30 cars in a zone. And like you said, at Kona, the gate's very, very busy, also very overwhelming because there's cars and people everywhere. But you very quickly forget that once you enter the reserve. And when you're in those zones, you don't feel like there's too many vehicles. Yes, you pass the odd car here and there, but sightings-wise as well, you don't feel overwhelmed by cars just because those zones are so well managed. So the way that we did it was that we would do one zone in the morning and then a different zone in the afternoon, and then repeat the following day, kind of thing. And which I think was a great idea, because it allows you to then explore different areas of the park. I think, was it Kano or Banafgar, where only 20% of the reserve has zones?
Yeah, it's Kano. So a big part of it is not open to tourism.
Exactly, which I think is also great. So there's 80% of the reserve which is completely untouched by humans. So there's four different zones in Kano, so 5% each, and I think it's roughly 30 vehicles allowed in each zone. And I mean, those zones are also big. It was nice to explore the different zones and just to see how different they were, because I mean, the vegetation changes from zone to zone.
It's so different.
And
I think Kano is probably the place with the most photographic potential. You know, if you find something, if you find a tiger, or because it also varies quite a bit. You've got these massive sol forests, these huge trees, and then you've got those meadows, more open grassland with the water holes. So, you know, if you do see something there, it usually is spectacular to photograph. So we spent 3 nights
there
at Kano, and then from there we went over to Banafgar. Which is, it's about just over a five-hour drive. We got to
King's Camp.
King's Camp. We didn't do a drive in Kano in the morning because we wanted to get to Banafgar for a drive in the afternoon. I think by our briefing was then at that stage, by the time we get to Banafgar, we've photographed the deers and the monkeys and all of, and the birds. Get to Banafgar, we could just focus on tigers again.
So I think the way that the trip was laid out was great. I mean, you, like you said, Todoba, you get that initial pressure of the tigers off. And then between Pench and Kano, you get a lot of the general game. And I mean, in those forests, early morning and late afternoon, the light is just
beautiful,
spectacular. And then you end off at Banafgar with a big bang. And I mean, I know throughout the trip we constantly joke. I never really got involved in it because I didn't want to put pressure on myself. But you know, Johan had obviously been there a couple of times, so he was pretty confident in the amount of tigers that we were going to see, and every day he seemed to add tigers to the list. But it paid off. I mean, the amount of tigers we saw there was incredible.
How many different tigers did we see there? 8, 9. So it must have been...
Lots.
12?
Yeah. Yeah.
12, 13 in the six... We did 6 game drives there again. Yeah, so...
Yeah. I mean,
that place is just... And, you know, there were quite a lot of females with cubs that we...
Yeah.
We only saw the individuals. We didn't see them all together.
Yeah.
So we could have easily have added like another 6 or 8.
Our first afternoon there, we saw... 4?
Yeah, something like that.
Because we had that once, and then we had that young female at the water.
Yeah.
Where it was literally just us two. When we said, okay, guys, there's tigers there, but there's lots of cars. Let's go try another water hole. And when literally we pulled into the water hole, we heard the langur monkey alarming.
Yeah.
And the next thing, this tiger appeared. Right. And it was unreal. So in terms of tiger viewing, Bun of God definitely delivered.
I think it's also the way the park is set out. You know, the roads are close to the water holes, the blocks are a lot smaller.
Yeah.
So even if a tiger moves into the forest, you can wait on the other side and there's a good chance it's going to pop out.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think, you know, those odds are a lot more in your favor to see them.
Yeah. And King's Camp itself, your thoughts on it?
Yeah, it's one of the bigger camps, but you know the only other option was the Treehouse Hideaway, which they've only got 4 rooms.
Yeah.
But King's Camp, yeah, very very comfortable. What I liked about it is they did separate areas for us during lunch, so it wasn't like we're sitting in a big communal sort of dining room and everyone's sitting together. They had a private section for us. I think where they did the dinners in the evening outside under the stars every night was beautiful. And again, I think the food was really good. The presentations were done outside as well. So I think that was really cool. And it's I like the location.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. Because also too far there, from the gates. What was nice there is that it's multiple gates.
Yes.
So it's not like Kana where it's one access point and everyone meets there. So a lot of the time we were either the first car or we were within the first 5 vehicles of being there. One thing I did want to mention about the 4 different kinds of accommodation that we had was what I really enjoyed about them. More so, I think, they all did it in their own unique way, but they've built in a lot of local material.
Yes.
So, you know, you and I would sit down for something simple, like we would sit down at the table, but it's made out of local wood.
Yeah.
And it is beautiful. So they've taken a lot of the building and stuff, the structure, it's all local rocks and things like that they've used to build the accommodation, which gave it a great feel.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I love the different lodges. And I also think, you know, you can also see with Pug Dundee, and we chatted about this during our safari, is you can... I mean, we know guides, and you often, you know, especially if you're on a trip, the last thing you want on a trip is guide envy. Mm. You know, you look in your vehicle and you think, oh, shit, now I wish we had that guide.
Yeah.
But, you know, you look at the guides that we had from Pug Dundee and you kind of scan around at the other vehicles, and you can tell a lot by the way that people dress and their appearance, the way they conduct themselves. And I must say, I think we did have some of the best guides in all of the parks.
I never got the feeling that there, and this isn't a comparison between anything, I never got the feeling that we were with a below average guide.
No.
I think also the way that, I think a huge part of these trips is the communication between us and the guides.
Yes.
And that was evident on the drives, was, you know, there was always information shared by the guides to us, and then a combined decision was made.
Yeah.
But I think also you having been there before gives them a good idea of the kind of experience that we're looking for.
Exactly. And that will just get stronger and stronger each year. And that will
get stronger each year, exactly.
Because there is maybe a little bit of a language barrier with some of them.
But a lot of, I've noticed a lot of hand movements.
Yeah, so this is like, we were doing a lot of these, like,
handshakes
means like there's nothing in the horizon. We modified that towards the end of the trip.
Yeah, but I, language aside, I think, you know, the effort made from their side was noticeable. And I never really felt like they went against what we said or we went against what they said. Obviously, they're the local guides and they know best. And there was a lot of cases where, you know, we put our faith in their hands. Sure. And they delivered.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm very comfortable and confident next year when we head back there that it'll be the same, if not better.
Mm, absolutely.
So, yeah. So, overall, it was... You know, I'm still writing up the trip reports and that for it, and going through images, and it's still a very overwhelming feeling of what we got to experience.
Yeah. So that trip report should be out soon in the next week or so.
Yeah.
Along with this podcast that we'll also put in there.
Yeah.
Let's keep it real. Tell me something that you didn't like about the trip, because I mean, like every single safari that you go on, you know, there's something that you don't like. Let's just as a something for people to maybe be aware of that you didn't enjoy.
Yes, I think you're whining about the flight back.
I was quite tired after a month.
I'm joking. It's not a dislike, but I think the food would be one thing. Mm-hmm. You know, typically, being a South African, I'm not big into Indian cuisine.
And there's no steak.
And so red meat obviously is a thing for me.
Yeah.
You know, but having said that, to me, it was a concern for me before going there, just because I knew what the food was going to be like. And like, I will be honest and admit, the first 2-3 days was tough to get into it.
Mm.
Just because, yes, the food's all prepped in a different way, but it's all similar types of food.
Yes.
And I must say, after the first 2-3 days was a bit tough to get into. I mean, when you're eating hot food and it's 40 degrees Celsius, it is quite difficult.
Yeah.
But you do get used to it. And I think, like I mentioned earlier, one of the good things was that, you know, the chef or the manager would come at each lodge and ask us how the food is and the spices, and do they need to turn it up, do they need to turn it down. And I think I got used to it really, really quickly, whereas, you know, I came back and last night, actually, I had Nando's and I ordered peri peri chicken and it actually wasn't hot.
Yeah.
You know, so
you're used to it now.
You get used to it. So I think, you know, if people do have concerns about the cuisine or anything like that, I think you've got to just give it a chance and you've got to embrace it, and you do get used to it.
Yeah.
It was a concern for me, but after 2-3 days, I mean, you get used to it, and you move on.
Yeah.
And for yourself?
I think that airport.
Yeah.
The airport in Delhi is an absolute dog show of night. It's the only airport that I've ever been to that you have to unpack your cameras out of your camera bag.
So not just your cameras, everything.
Everything that's got a cable. So your cameras, your lenses, external hard drives, chargers, everything has to. And then you get those trays that you normally just put your laptop and your belt and everything in.
You've
now your cameras and things have to go in there as well.
Yeah.
And it's quite a busy airport. But, you know, it's maybe like an hour of absolute hatred.
And then,
you know, once that's done, it's done.
But I also think a big part of that, and I don't know, like, if you had it in your trip a couple of years ago, if it was the same story then.
Yeah, we do. I remember the flight from Delhi to Nagpur, we had to unpack all of our cameras. But the flight from Jabalpur back to Delhi, you don't have to.
No.
And then if you fly out of Delhi again on your international flight, then you have to again.
Yeah.
So it's like, why for one airport? And I mean, look, they obviously have their reasons for that,
yeah.
You know, with possible terrorist threats or something in the past. I don't know. But it just seems, it's a bit of a headache, but, you know, it's that one day and then it's over and done with.
Yeah. But I think it, with travel, and especially traveling now, it is getting easier. I mean, how nice was it not to have to do a PCR test to come home?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just in the last week, Uganda's done the same thing. They've dropped the PCR testing.
Yeah.
So I think travel is going to get easier, but that what you mentioned now about unpacking and all of that kind of thing, it's just one of those things, I guess. You know, every airport's different. It can be a frustration. I mean, I pack my camera bag very poorly, so I literally unpacked every piece of camera equipment that I owned out. But it is worth it. It definitely is worth it.
What would you recommend for people, you know, listening to this, wanting to join us for next year? From a photographic point of view, cameras or lenses, well, not really cameras, but lenses to take with, and you know, something like an extra tip or something to consider before coming on the safari.
Camera-wise, you know, there's so many different photographic opportunities. So for this trip, I took 70-200, and then I took Canon gear, 70-200, 2.8, which is nice, especially early morning, late afternoon with low light, mm-hmm. To have that 2.8. And then I took the 200-400 with the built-in converter, just for that extra reach, especially because not all the water holes are close to the road. So when you have tigers and things coming to drink, you want something a little bit more. Yep. I would even advise a minimum of 600 mils.
Especially if
you want close-up portraits. But yeah. I think having two camera bodies, you know, either having a 70-200 or 100-400 on one, and then having like a fixed 600 on the other.
That'll be power.
It would work really, really well. I wasn't too worried about the wide-angle stuff because, you know, especially with phones and the quality of phones these days, I mean, I took some great landscape shots just with my iPhone.
Yeah.
Travel tip, a definite one would be something to cover your cameras with. Mm. Just because there is a lot of dust.
Yeah. It's dry season. It's very dusty. A lot of dust.
Yeah. So just more for protection more than anything else is just to have something as simple as a pillowcase just to cover your camera equipment, and maybe also just to pack a small cleaning kit for your camera gear. I think that makes a massive difference.
Yeah. No, I think that's spot on.
Would your tip be? Outside of camera equipment.
Rehydrate.
That's a very good one.
Just hydration salts, you know, because it does get hot, and often, you know, when you're photographing and things, you do forget to drink a lot of water. I think the camps are very good. They give you that lemon water.
Which is delicious.
Delicious. Very refreshing. They'll give you stainless steel bottles for water to take with. But I sometimes just like a rehydrate just for between safaris in the morning and afternoon, or maybe in the evening once you're back, just to try and get some of those salts,
electrolytes
back in.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I think you've got it spot on with camera gear and just something to cover your camera because it does get very dusty.
Yeah.
So guys, dates are out for next year. We're just doing the final costing on that, so that should hopefully be done in the next week or so. But if you're interested, then get a hold of Trevor and myself. Trev, what's your Instagram handle?
It's just Trev McCall Pete, all lowercase letters and all one word.
Or on email?
Trevor@wild-eye.co.za.
Perfect. Or you guys can get a hold of me also, Johan@wild-eye.co.za, or on Instagram, Johan van Zyl Photography. Let us know. There's we've already got three people waitlisted on that. Okay. So potentially we've got that trip will be 50% full. And then hopefully if it's full, then we can open up another one.
Yeah.
Get some more people on there. Because it is a cool experience. It is very different. And I think it's authentic, which I quite enjoy.
Yeah. And I think if any of you listening to this are considering going to India and have any concerns, definitely get in touch with us.
Yeah.
We're both more than happy to answer any of your questions, but from my experience, you know, it is a completely different world. It's a completely different experience, but I can guarantee you it is an experience that you will carry for the rest of your life.
Yeah. And I think you just got to be honest with some people's concerns, you know, I think it's often, you know, the parks being busy and the food and possibly the heat. I think that's often three concerns for four people.
Yeah.
But yeah, like Trevor said, if you guys have any questions, get in touch with us and we'll give you honest feedback.
Absolutely.
Trev, thank you so much, bud.
Thank you, Johan.
Look forward to doing this again next year. And yeah, guys, keep an eye out for that trip report coming out in the next week or so.
Yep.
All right.
All right. Cool. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening. Cheers. Bye.